From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. W, in a 10-gallon hat and cowboy boots, the ranch in Crawford, the childhood in Midland. There's no denying that our president is from Texas, even though his address is Pennsylvania Avenue. Michael Lind argues in his new book, Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, that the president comes from a Texas historically divided into two conflicting camps, the egalitarian hill country world of LBJ and the traditional caste system Texas of conquistadors, oil barons, and George W. In the latter, rich white patricians are in control. The working class has little say in the hard politics of the old South rule. The Texas conservatism of George W. Bush, says Lind, combines 17th century religion, 18th century economics, and 19th century imperialism. It amounts, he says, to a counter-revolution of Southern conservatism that is dragging America back from all that is progressive and much, says Lind, that is good. Do you feel America is being remade in the mold of big oil men, rich ranchers, and cheap labor? Is a tall Texan high in the saddle what the country needs in these uncertain times? Or is George W. herding America onto a bad old trail? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now, Michael Lind. His new book is Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. He is a senior fellow of the New American Foundation and director of its American Strategy Program. Good evening and welcome, Michael Lind.
Howdy.
Howdy. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Howdy, Jack.
Howdy, and hello, Michael.
Howdy's all around. Michael Lind, your book is hot as a pistol and in some ways makes one feel, reading it, like we're meeting George W. Bush for the first time. I guess if you'll dive right in for us with a little history here, you draw the line between the Old South, the culture and politics and economics of the Old South, and part of Texas. You say that Texas has two traditions and that many folks outside Texas don't always know the difference. Give us that bifurcation, that two Texas tradition. What is it?
Well, as I say in Made in Texas, Texas is actually the intersection of three different regions of the Old South. Part of Texas has connections with the Midwest, the hill country and parts of the panhandle, and then the Southwest extends along the Mexican border. Historically, the Southwest, the Mexican-American part of Texas, was of very little significance because it was a white supremacist state in which Latinos were effectively disenfranchised along with African-Americans. So the real battle within Texas has been between what you might call the southern part of Texas, which is predominantly East Texas, where the vast majority of Texans have lived and continue to live, and the central Texas region, the Midwestern part of Texas, which, like much of the rest of the United States and like the Midwest, is ethnically mixed, had a very important German and Scandinavian influence, and in its politics was more like a progressive prairie state like Nebraska or like Minnesota. And Lyndon Johnson came from central Texas. So when people say that Johnson was the first southern president since the Civil War, that's not quite true. It overlooks Woodrow Wilson and Harry Truman, who were born in the South, or at least were cultural southerners. But it also neglects the fact that Lyndon Johnson himself came from a majority German-American county, which had been pro-Lincoln and anti-Confederate during the Civil War, which had always opposed the Southern Democrats in its politics, voting for Republicans or for progressives.
And for the Union.
And, Johnson really came from a political culture that was much more similar to that of Hubert Humphrey.
But you say when George W. looks at us across the fence on his ranch in Crawford, Texas, what's behind those eyes is quite a different tradition.
Well, that's right. Bush's Texas, not only East Texas but West Texas, which until recently was largely settled by Southerners without African Americans, is the westernmost extension of the Old South. Texas was a Confederate state. It was a member in good standing of the Solid South. It had one of the most rigidly segregated societies and political systems. Southern Texas, was very similar in its politics and values to Alabama and to Mississippi and to other southern states. Its essential characteristics are these. In its economy, it's a commodity exporting state.
And the significance of that?
Were cotton and cattle and then oil. Well, the significance is it's really a pre-industrial state. It was only the federal government, really, partly during the New Deal, but especially during World War II and later, where the federal government itself, under Franklin Roosevelt and his successors, industrialized Texas from above. Up until that time, it had essentially been a rural resource colony of the factories of the Midwest and of the financiers of the Northeast. So in many ways, it was more like a Central American banana republic where the local oligarchic families spoke English.
We'll come back and look at that. You also say there's a powerful military tradition here.
Well, that's right. But the thing you have to understand about both the economy and the military tradition in Texas is that Texan society, like that of other southern states, is not bourgeois. That is, it's not a capitalist, middle-class, entrepreneurial culture. It's aristocratic. The dominant tradition in the South, from Virginia all the way west to Texas, there's been some Scots-Irish sort of yeoman farmer influence. But traditionally, the elite culture goes back not to the merchants of Britain, not to the middle class, not to the entrepreneurial bourgeoisie, as is the case in New England, for example, but rather to the Virginia Cavaliers, who come out of the knights. They were the aristocrats. They were the landed gentlemen.
The Virginia Cavaliers, and you draw the line right on back across the Atlantic to British aristocracy and literally armor-clad medieval knights.
Well, that's right, and in many of the leading southern families are quite proud to trace their pedigrees back to aristocratic Brits. Now, they may be exaggerating sometime, but the point is not whether they actually have these blue-blooded pedigrees or not. The point is that contrary to the myth of J.R. Ewing, you know, the southern businessman, a businessman, you know, and by the way, nobody says business in Texas. This is a Yankee myth, I have to tell you.
All right.
This is not primarily an enterprise culture or a business culture. It's a very militaristic, aristocratic culture. The highest aspiration of traditional Texans, as of their southern cousins, is to be called Colonel.
Colonel. Michael Lind, I want to get and be sure. We've read this. Many of our listeners will not have read it yet. I hope they do. It's a very hot book. I want to be sure that this doesn't come off sounding wholly academic here when we look at genealogy and who's come from where. We'll come back to each of these elements, but give us the kind of the Texas lowdown here on the impact of that culture, which you say George W. represents, coming into the White House.
Well, George W. Bush is an authentic cultural Texan, and he's also an authentic cultural Southerner, even though he comes from a Northeastern family, and even though he was born in Connecticut, from the time he was an infant. He was raised in this very homogenous Anglo-American Southern Protestant enclave in West Texas, which is very similar to the majority tradition in Texas, centered in East Texas.
And now that he's in the White House, what does it matter?
It affects his approach to economics. This entire supply-side approach, which he's reviving from Ronald Reagan, if you go back to, for example, the tax cuts, you know, and the claim that that deficits don't matter because growth will pay for itself. If you go back to the original Reagan tax cuts in the 1980s, as I've done elsewhere, you find out there's a regional divide, even within Republicans, even among conservatives, between the Northeastern and Midwestern fiscal conservatives who are horrified by deficits. It's, you know, the tradition of Yankee thrift is not entirely a myth. Mm. And most of the support for the original Kemp-Roth tax cuts came from Southerners and Westerners. It's part of this culture, not only a spendthrift culture of an upper class that could never balance its books all the way back into the 18th century, but a deliberate attempt to downsize government. Because the other thing about this tradition is it's the tradition of the Confederates and of states' rights. The Southern Democratic conservatives, who are responsible for the tradition that now dominates the Republican Party since they've taken it over in the past couple of decades, they never made peace with Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. They collaborated with Roosevelt and the federal government in the 30s as long as they could get spending on infrastructure projects, you know, subsidies to big agribusiness corporations and so on. But they rebelled against Roosevelt starting in 1936 and 38.
And you say that they've rebelled a number of times. Michael, in your book, you've got a real hell's a poppin' kind of summary of what's going on here. Allow me just to read it back to you and to Jack Beatty, and then Jack, I want to hear from you. But you say, Michael Lind, from its conception of economics in terms of the exploitation of cheap labor and the plundering of non-renewable natural resources, and its plan to replace the modern social safety net with faith-based religious charity, to its minimal government political theory, its bellicose militarism, and its Bible Belt Christian Zionism, the second Bush administration illustrates the centuries-old traditions of the Southern oligarchy. Today's Southern right combines the political economy of plantation owners with the fundamentalist religion of hillbillies. You say the capture on Inauguration Day 2001 of the vast power of the federal apparatus by Southern reactionaries and their allies means that in the administration of George W. Bush, the Southern oligarchs are a threat to the peace and well-being not only of America but of the world. Jack Beatty, there's Michael Lind's words, and they're just about as hot as they get. What do you make of it?
Well, I am a completely unreconstructed Yankee, and I know practically nothing about the South except that I've been fascinated with it, as anyone who likes American literature is for all my life. And I find this book very, very interesting indeed. And as you say, Tom, it sort of opens up a new Bush. It contextualizes Bush. But I wonder if in contextualizing Bush in his region, Michael doesn't sometimes reduce him to that region. After all, Bush in the campaign spoke about the necessity for the United States showing humility in foreign affairs. And when he was asked at one point about, why did your father not proceed to Baghdad? He said, we don't want to be an imperialist army invading someone else's capital. And he talked about he wanted to have less defense spending than Al Gore, and even with Mexico he wanted to somehow regularize the status of illegal immigrants. Now I realize that's something that's very controversial in all sorts of ways, but at least showed that he had some thought for a kind of Texas, for what's happening along the border, that something has to be done one way or another. And you could almost see that this was seemed to have been his plan, and you could say, well, he was deflected from this by September 11th. And you could almost say that in this talk about humility and lack of intervention and so on, he was representing another Southern tradition, the one that C. Van Woodward identifies, the Southern sense of the limits to what you can do with history, the South steeped in defeat. And that consciousness that history can't be managed, that you bumptious Yankees can't just, amend existence this way, mm-hmm. that this seemed to me some of part of Bush's pre-September 11th orientation.
Michael Lind, what about it? Do you make George Bush's spurs out a little too sharp here, or is there something that we're just not seeing? Or is it right in front of us?
I wish that George W. Bush were informed by the tragic wisdom of C. Van Woodward, and William Faulkner and other great Southern writers. I fear that during the campaign, when he was talking about the limits to U.S. intervention, he was talking about peacekeeping and nation building in places like the Balkans, which is extremely unpopular with his conservative base in the South in particular, but across the country. Mm-hmm. Many of them are extremely suspicious of alliances and of international institutions. And in fact, there's one Texas soldier who refused to participate in peacekeeping in Bosnia when he was ordered to do so by his superiors because he had to wear a UN beret. And, there are all these theories about the UN and a world government. So Bush is a politician, and he was sort of playing to two audiences. I mean, he may have been sincere. Certainly, he's changed his mind since 9/11. The national strategy guidelines that he released, called for essentially unilateral American world domination.
Preemptive
enforced
war.
Enforced by a preventive war. And the same guidelines warned other countries not to engage in preventive war on their own. So the U.S. is the only one that has permission. I have to take issue with Jack about regularizing immigration from Mexico. This is a cynical plot by ranchers and growers in Texas to essentially substitute guest workers from Mexico for native-born American workers, including Latinos, which is why many Latino activists have fought tooth and nail against this. And the people who were in favor of Bush's plan tended to be reactionary conservatives like Texas Senator Phil Graham.
Michael Lind, hold it there. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the first Texas conservative to be president, George W. Bush, and the implications of that Texas tradition for America and the world. Can you see, can you feel the Texas tradition that Michael Lind describes in the George W. Bush presidency? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the first Texas conservative to be president, George W. Bush, and the implications of that Texas tradition for America and the world. Our guest tonight is Michael Lind. He's author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And here's the question. Is the country being remade in the mold of big oil men, aristocrat ranchers, and cheap labor? Do we have a Lone Star State foreign policy? Does Michael Lind's Texas interpretation explain George W. Bush to you? Do you buy it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Lind, walk us through some of the details here. You describe something you call Southernomics, and you began to get into it, but tell us what it is and tell us how you see it playing out then in current Bush administration policy around economics.
Well, to begin with, it's the opposite of old-fashioned Republican economics. Abraham Lincoln and the founders of the Republican Party were protectionists. They pushed through 40% to 50% tariffs on imported manufactured goods in order to stimulate American manufacturing. And as long as the Republican Party was the party of New England and the Midwest, well up until the 50s, there was a very powerful pro-manufacturing protectionist wing of the Republican Party. It's only as the Republican Party has been infiltrated and taken over by Southerners that the traditional Southern approach to free trade has prevailed. And the reason the Southerners were always in favor of free trade was they did not want to have an industrialized society. They were agrarians. They were rich landowners and farmers and ranchers and plantation owners. Jefferson Davis explains in his inaugural address as president of the Confederate States of America that the Confederacy will practice a policy of free trade, so it will export agricultural products to Europe and import manufactured goods from other countries. That way it doesn't have to be corrupted by having factories and factory workers in big cities.
But so you're not saying George W. Bush wants all America to be a cotton plantation in the year 2003, surely?
No, this is just such a part of the dogma and the culture in Texas and the South.
So how does it play out
now? Anyone who questions free trade is considered to be some sort of communist or maniac. In the same way that in much of the Midwest, protectionism used to be an equally rigid dogma because that's where the manufacturing was. I'll give you another example of Southernomics. The people who belong to what I call the modernizing tradition in Texas, including Lyndon Johnson and Ross Perot — Johnson and Perot are quite different, but they're both committed to the same vision of a very high-tech, space-age society based on government-supported research and development and a highly educated population. What is one of Bush's major priority in terms of education? It's true he's in favor of standards. This is a bandwagon that he jumped onto. But at the same time, he has repeatedly said in public that Darwin was probably wrong. Now, think about that. Here we have in the 21st century, first president of the 21st century, saying that Darwin was wrong because he disagreed with a literal interpretation of the Bible.
Does that suggest then that he wants to close down high technology industries across America and Platte Cotton? I mean, I'm trying to. We all look at George Bush, and I suppose we imagine he thinks like we do. You're saying he doesn't. He thinks differently from many Americans. What does it mean for how he is approaching?
He doesn't want to close down high-tech industry. He just knows nothing whatsoever about it. It's a completely foreign world to him. As governor of Texas, he was in Austin, which is the center of the Austin tech community. He paid little attention to it. He didn't understand it. He essentially understands the old-fashioned pre-industrial commodity sector of agriculture, of oil mining, which even though oil is used in industrial civilization, it's essentially a pre-industrial land-based kind of a commodity product. If you want to have a modern high-tech society, you have to have world-class education funded at world-class levels. And at the same time, you have to insist that young Americans be taught genuine science, not ancient mythology as though it were some sort of a rival modern Darwinian science.
Jack Beattie, if I can draw you in here, Michael Lind's talking about Southernomics. Is it catching you? Do you see it?
Well, it makes sense in a lot of ways. One of Bush's first steps as president was to end the OSHA regulations that had been promulgated in the latter days of the Clinton administration, and that had been a decade in the making, and that were aimed above all at the ergonomic safety of workers in places, in chicken plants, people who literally work their fingers to the bone. And these regulations would protect them. Enlightened businesses all over the country were ready to embrace them and to make the changes necessary, and Business Week even ran a piece saying, oh, this looks like it's not going to have much business opposition to it, because people recognize that if people are always going mm-hmm. home with digital problems, that you're losing productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Mr. Bush, backed by the votes of Southern Democrats, ended this and essentially said, you know, I mean, to me, that just made such – it fits into this picture of cheap – not only cheap labor, but degraded labor. But not caring about the merest sort of decencies of a man's hands and people's physical safety.
Michael Lind, we thought maybe he just cared about efficiency, but you're saying this is the conquistador who doesn't care about the peon.
Well, that's right. You know, in Texas growing up, I used to meet various roustabouts who had worked on oil rigs, you know, and had lost a finger or had been injured and so on, and they never sued. You know, and they never claimed damages and so on, because it was this kind of fatalistic peasant culture. And the whole idea was, you know, if your hand got chopped off, you know, because of the equipment, well, you know, God had just assigned this. You know, it was an act of God. The very idea of suing your employer or heaven forbid, getting, you know, federal government inspectors in there to make the equipment safer was just totally unknown to this kind of fatalistic Southern culture, which, sad to say, as in many third world countries, is accepted by the poor and the working classes as much as by the elite. Let me just point out, this is not George W. Bush by himself. I mean, this is an entire a group of Southern politicians. The last time the minimum wage was raised in the United States in the mid-90s, Newt Gingrich, then Speaker of the House, a Southern Republican from Georgia, argued on the floor of the U.S. Congress that raising the minimum wage would cripple the United States by reducing its advantage in competing with Mexican labor. Now, I think many Americans would be surprised to learn that, according to Gingrich and his fellow Southerners, including some Southern Democrats as well as Republicans, that the basis of American economic strength is not an educational system, first-rate scientists, first-rate engineers, world-class venture capitalists, you know, brilliant entrepreneurs. It's cheap labor.
So there's your Southernomics in a nutshell, part of what you call the counter-revolution of Southern conservatism. Let's move to foreign policy. You describe Bush there as this bellicose, militaristic aristocrat. What's the tradition, the Texas tradition that you define here, that you see? How does it filter through to foreign policy today?
Well, we only have polling data for the attitudes, the foreign policy attitudes of Americans going back to the early and mid-20th century. But as long as there have been polls going back to the 30s and the World War II era, Southerners have been more ready to intervene militarily in wars, in any war, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam, you know, the Gulf War, whatever. And Southerners, white Southern conservatives, have been more hostile to alliances like NATO and to international institutions like the United Nations than white Protestants, you know, the control group in other parts of the United States. So when Bush comes to power and breaks with previous bipartisan American tradition by canceling more treaties than any president in history, by waging the war in Afghanistan without NATO, even though NATO volunteered to help us out, you know, and then having this whole debate about whether to take part with our allies or the United Nations in Iraq, I was not surprised. The foreign policy establishment doesn't know what's going on. Well, what's going on is that someone with the typical attitude of a Southern governor or, you know, any number of Southern politicians for the first time is making American foreign policy. His father was a transitional figure. He's very interesting because he came out of that old Northeastern patrician business establishment,
Bush
was
Sr.
a conservative internationalist. At the same time, he was moving to the right, you know, and trying to establish his bona fides with the Southern conservatives. The son has gone all the way. At this point, there's not the slightest shred of the old Northeastern establishment internationalism left. He's a Southern unilateralist, pure and simple.
And you talk about very specifically and at some length what you call Bible Belt Christian Zionism. You say you're talking about the Israelization of American foreign policy. I want to understand this. You say, thanks to the influence of the Israeli model on neoconservatives in the Bush administration, the United States, the leading power in the world, began acting as though, this is under George W., as though it were an insecure and besieged international pariah state like Israel under the leadership of the Likud party. Really?
Well, that's exactly right. The dominant coalition that's shaping our foreign policy today is a coalition between Southern Protestant fundamentalists, Southern Baptists, Pentecostalists, Church of Christ, others, who believe in what's called a dispensationalist theology. They believe that God was behind the establishment of Israel in 1948 and that God was behind Israel's annexation of the territories in 1967, and that according to promises made by Abraham, all of the land of the former Palestine Mandate belongs to the Jews, and therefore the Arabs should be ethnically cleansed. This is widely believed. It's preached in pulpits throughout the South.
But surely George W. Bush is not that literal a Christian. He doesn't look at Jerusalem and see the Alamo.
It's an interesting question to me. I tend to think, since I grew up in Texas, where you could be a governor or a CEO or a bank vice president and believe literally in Adam and Eve and in a Noah's Ark.
And what do you mean by the Israelization of American foreign policy? What do you mean exactly?
Well, by that I mean that the American neoconservative right, not all American conservatives, obviously there are people like Patrick Buchanan, you know, they're traditional internationalists on the right, like Jim Baker as well, but the neoconservatives, whose constituency now consists of right-wing Jewish Americans who are very pro-Likud, pro-Sharon in Israel, and their allies among these pro-Israel Southern fundamentalists. Ever since the 1980s, when I worked with many of them, I was a neoconservative Democrat, and I worked with many of these conservatives in the 1980s and early 1990s. They looked to Israel, weirdly enough, as a model for U.S. foreign policy. For example, Israel's raid on Iraq's Osirik reactor, when they bombed Iraq's a nuclear reactor. At the time, that was denounced by President Reagan and by Prime Minister Thatcher. But
of course, since it's been widely praised by many people, saying it saved us a lot of trouble down the road.
Well, that's right. And that is the model. It's the unacknowledged model for the Bush administration's talk about preventive war. In the past decade, and again, I follow this, it's not been reported adequately in the press. Many of the leading figures of the Bush administration in print, I mean, this is not some sort of rumor or something, it's in print, in letters and testimony to Congress, have advocated preventive war against Iraq. They've called for the U.S. to bomb or threaten to bomb Iran, Syria, and North Korea. And also some have speculated about bombing Libya as well.
So whatever you call it, whatever the model, whatever the origin, you're saying there's a traditional, a conservative tradition here that is going to lead us into, has put us in a more bellicose posture, is going to mean more armed conflict.
It's a Southern conservative tradition. Interestingly enough, it's the complete opposite of the old Robert Taft conservatism of the mid-20th century, because just as the old Republicans of, say, 1950 were protectionists, whereas the new Southern conservatives are free traders, the old mid-century Midwestern conservatives tended to be isolationists, and or at least they wanted a minimal foreign policy. And they were at the opposite extreme, you know, 50 years ago from today's Southern Republicans. And this illustrates the difference, not between left and right ideology, but between the traditional culture of the South and that of the Midwest.
Michael Lynn, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. Kate's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Well, I'm not taking issue with any of the criticisms that have been made about George Bush's economic policies, his treatment of workers, or his foreign policy.
Well, but okay.
I'm not taking issue with his opinions of them. What I am taking issue with or questioning is the blanket assumption that this stems from his Southern roots in Texas. And the reason is this. I grew up, the children of New Englanders in the South, and have seen many politicians who are not, number one, born and bred in the South, come in and exploit some what are seen as traditional Southern viewpoints or prejudices or biases in order to gain the votes of the people that they are looking to represent.
You mean just take on the trappings, Kate? Just take on the trappings and the language.
The posture. And my question with George Bush, George W. Bush, is he had access, you know, it's one thing to say that he grew up in this isolated, homogenous section of Texas, but this is someone educated at Phillips you know, at Andover Academy. He went to Yale. His father traveled in circles that your average boy of Texas did not experience.
Kate, I'm going to put that to Michael Lynn, but before I do, let me ask you, does it matter if he's just taking on the trappings or if it's the genuine article? Does it matter in policy terms?
Perhaps not in policy terms, but in motivations. To be honest, I think it makes me a little more nervous if it is just posture, in the sense that I can understand whether I agree with someone's positions or not. I can understand someone being steeped in the traditions of the environment in which they were, in which they grew up and what they were exposed to.
If but it's I the real soil that, under the fingernails.
Right. I would argue that his exposure is a little more worldly than simply West Texas.
Kate, it's a great question, and thank you for your call. Michael Lynn, what about it? Is George W. in fact a kind of rhinestone cowboy, not the real deal, just posturing? Or if he is, in your view, the real deal, does he have the extra enthusiasm for the culture that a kind of immigrant might have?
Well, there is a certain amount of posturing. I own a little ranch not far down the road from his, and we all laugh when we see him on TV with his big old Stetson hat, you know, out there clearing brush at the middle of August when it's 98 degrees, you know, which no real rancher would ever do.
Of course, LBJ was not too shy about showing off his Texas culture roots either.
No, but Johnson also, you know, was sort of the real article. He would drive around in a Cadillac drinking beer and smoking, you know, so that was, you know, shooting deer from the back of his Lincoln Continental. So
but what about the New Haven birth, the aristocratic Northeastern Yankee tradition in the family, the education at Yale and Harvard?
Well,
does all that
is,
cut the whiskey here a little bit?
Yeah, I think he's gone native. And I think the proof of this is when he was 39, and he's written, you know, this has been written about in his biographies. He's told lots of reporters about this. After his dissolute life, he was brought back to Jesus, to this kind of very hardcore Protestant evangelicalism, which is quite different from the mainline Protestantism that he was raised with, by none other than the Reverend Billy Graham. And Bush himself has repeatedly told this story to various reporters, and it's been publicized, that when his father was in the White House, right after George W. had been born again, he had a debate with George Herbert Walker Bush and with Barbara Bush about whether non-Christians go to hell or not. And he, with the zeal of a convert, insisted that they did. Now, this is George W. Bush was telling the story himself a few years ago. His parents, being nice East Coast Protestants, said, well, George, surely, you know, some non-Christians, you know, must go to heaven. And from the White House itself, according to George W. Bush, they used the vast telecommunications technology of the presidency to track down and have a conference call with the Reverend Billy Graham
on this
issue of whether non-Christians go to hell or not.
Well, I'm not even sure I want to know how they sorted that out. But
Graham sided with George W. Bush, but then he said, who are we to play God? Now, I think that indicates a certain cultural gap. Mm. As well as a generation gap between the elder
Bush Senior, Bush Junior. Jack Beatty, do you see a Bush that's gone fully native in Michael Lynn's description?
It's certainly very interesting, and he sounds as if he has although I can remember people saying something similar about the sort of dual character of LBJ, not Yankee and Southern, but cowboy and Southern. But I do hear the Procrustean logic here that Michael is using. You know, I mean, after all, Bush has done steel tariffs. He has resorted to protection that Clinton didn't do. And we still haven't answered the question whether 9/11 deflected him and catapulted him into this foreign policy.
We'll come back and look at that, Jack. We've got to take a short break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the first Texas conservative to be president of the United States, George W. Bush, and the implications of that his Texas tradition, for America and the world. Our guest is fifth-generation Texan Michael Lind. He's author of the new book, Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And if you don't hear it, you should. This book is hot. Question is, who rules the Bush soul, the Connecticut Yankee or the Texas oil baron? Does Michael Lynn's portrait leave you feeling like you're meeting G.W. Bush for the first time? Do you like what you see? Do you want a tough Texas Ranger riding tall in the saddle these days? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Jonathan's calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi. I grew up with the conquistador of question here, and
how literally? Jonathan, how literally do you mean that? You grew up with G.W.?
Oh, he's my first cousin.
Okay, so what do you say?
And, you know, he also unfortunately drove one or two Cadillacs with one or two beers and one or two cigarettes. And definitely, you know, the idea of him, the very thought of him, I must say, as kind of a hard-riding, you know, simple-minded, you know, aspire to be called Colonel Southern Traditionalist Land Guy is kind of funny. I mean, you know, he did go to Yale and Phillips and HBS, and he is an incredibly sophisticated politician and guy.
And you're just not buying the characterization of all that Texas dust seeping in and shaping the man.
Well, I think Texas dust is one thing, but the author's from Texas, too, and the idea of Texas dust rendering conquistadors is a little much. I mean, I submit to you that he's kind of a sophisticated guy, even relative to his dad in terms of political sensitivity, and knows how to motivate the populace, which includes pulling on the traditions that are, you know, relevant.
Jonathan, there's no question about that. We've got a first cousin on the line here, Michael Lind. He's challenging your characterization. Jonathan, stay with us. Michael Lind, what do you make of the pushback?
Well, I don't know. I've met Bush once, very briefly. I have no idea personally whether he is just faking this. I mean, maybe he's, you know, really this sort of a Northeastern sophisticate who's manipulating all of the yokels to promote himself politically. If he is, he's one of the most cynical hypocrites we've seen in American history, the way he at least pretends to be a born-again Christian, denouncing Darwin, things like that. How many Northeastern sophisticates repeatedly denounce Darwin in public? If he's doing this for political gain, then he's a hypocrite. I assume that it has something to do with his born-again evangelical Protestantism, but maybe his stories about being a born-again Christian are a lie as well. I really, you know, since I don't have insight into him, I do have an insight into his political persona, as well as into the political culture that has produced not only him, but Dick Armey, Tom DeLay, many of these other Southern Republican leaders who come out of the Southern Democratic tradition.
Cousin Jonathan,
again,
what do you say?
You know, who knows?
Cousin Jonathan, are you there?
Yeah. And I'm getting up off the floor on the hypocrite comment. Just a minute, I got to dust off.
All right.
Does he believe in Darwin or not?
What?
Does he believe that Darwin was wrong, as he has said in public?
Is he sincere or not? He is certainly a very serious Christian, and he certainly wrestles with those kinds of issues all of the time. And
how many sophisticates in the Northeast say that Darwin was wrong?
But to say that, therefore, he's got this sort of land-based, oil-based, you know, disengaged kind of machismo driving his foreign policy after September 11th is such a stretch, especially when compared to all of his public statements and efforts before September 11th, which were very, you know, almost the opposite of military and expansionist and, you know, unilateralist and you know, so militarist. This is a guy who wanted to leave no child behind and had a whole bunch of ideas around that, had much more interested in foreign policy with Mexico than with, you know, detente in France. And you know, after getting his heart broken and, you know, along with maybe some of the rest of us on September 11th, he suddenly got, you know, a serious wake-up call and determined that, unfortunately, deeply unfortunately, he had to put off those agenda items until the economy and the society, or I should say the society and therefore the economy, could feel safe.
Jonathan,
so
there's
a change of plan, and now all of a sudden, it was preordained because he's really a conquistador from Texas.
We've got it, Cousin Jonathan, and we thank you for your call, and we hear your ringing defense there. Thanks for calling in, but we're running out of time. Michael Lind, I want to get your response there, and I guess take us back as well, to your main theme, where we're headed.
Yeah, can I inject some
Please.
Reality here?
Mm-hmm.
The Bush administration was divided, but George W. Bush doesn't dream up his foreign policy at night. I mean, you know, his role in the administration, like that of many presidents, is to come down on one side or another between competing factions in his administration. From the time he was inaugurated, there were two competing factions. There were the traditional realists and internationalists, like his father and like James Baker, who in this administration were organized around Secretary of State Powell and most of the uniformed military, who are deeply suspicious of this president. On the other side were neoconservatives, of whom the intellectual and policy leaders were Vice President Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz, who's the real strategic mastermind of this administration. He's the number two man at the Pentagon under Rumsfeld.
Yes.
Cheney and Wolfowitz had wanted to go all the way to Baghdad in the first Gulf War. They lost the argument in the first Bush administration. The argument was resumed from the time George W. Bush was inaugurated, and Bush himself went back and forth between these two camps.
Michael Lind, we are almost out of time. Give us your 20-second summary, if you will, of where you see us heading, in your view, under this president with this background.
Well, it's not simply this president. As I point out in my book, Made in Texas, for the past 30 years, Southern conservatives have been moving out of the Democratic Party and taking over the Republican leadership, which makes a difference now that the Republicans are the majority party in the United States. So not only can you not understand George W. Bush without his constituency in the former Confederate states, you cannot understand most of the Republican leaders and most Republican policies in 2003.
Michael Lind, you provoke us to think, and we thank you for being with us tonight. Michael Lind is author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Jack Beatty, we've got 10 seconds here. Wow, it's hot. What do you think?
Yahoo, I guess.
That's about all we've got time for. So long, Padna.
Yeah. Yep.
Stay tuned. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums in a moment. A tightrope walker who defied death at the World Trade Center in 1974. This is On Point. Philippe Petit was an 18-year-old high wire walker sitting in a Parisian dentist's office when he read about the Twin Towers being built in New York City. He vowed then to walk a wire between the towers. Years later, he began gathering resources and accomplices, including a skilled archer who could shoot a line between the two buildings for his artistic coup. On the morning of August 7th, 1974, Philippe Petit made history, crossing the 110-story chasm between the World Trade Towers 8 times in 1 hour. The account of Petit's years of plotting and daring act is told in a new book, To Reach the Clouds, My High Wire Walk Between the Twin Towers. We spoke to Petit from his home in Paris, where he read from his book and talked about an act that will now, can never, be repeated.
The volume of the towers, their size, scream one word at me, etches it into my skin as I posed atop the stairs, holding on to the railing. Impossible. I cannot breathe, cannot move, talk, think. I am dismayed, my dream dissolved. I feel fear. Glued to the railing, I am an invalid. I stare, I look, I glance, I observe, I watch. My scrutiny yields only two monoliths beyond all scale and carves deeper into me the word impossible. Defeated, disgusted, I am about to retreat, but the bold capital U of the towers changes into a powerful horseshoe magnet of gargantuan proportions that draws me nearer its footing. Avoiding the guards, I trespass onto the plaza, which is still under construction. I reach one of the towers. Facing a corner, I position myself an inch away from the 7-foot-wide metallic face. At my feet, the connection between vertical aluminum panel and horizontal concrete slab is flawless. But surely the wall does not start where I stand. It must surge from the entrails of the earth. I press my chin against the cold aluminum, forcing my eyes upward in search of the end of the wall. There is no end. This wall has no top. Instead, it becomes sky, aluminum into azure. To tell the story, the first scene of that 6 years long story is when I discovered the existence of the Twin Towers. And it actually happened when I was 18 years old in 1968 in Paris. And I was in a dentist waiting room, and somehow my eyes caught a small article with a picture, not of the towers, because they didn't exist at the time, but of a model announcing that one day those towers will be built and they will become the highest in the world. And as a kid, you know, I really wanted this article because I had started to be a wire walker self-taught. So I didn't know how to steal that page. Everybody was looking at me. Everybody was silent, was very French, austere surrounding. Finally, I started a giant sneezing, and under the cover of the sneeze, I tear out the page, throw it under my shirt, and left the room. Of course, I had to find another dentist, but that day I acquired a dream. It was the biggest high-wire walk of my life. It was illegal, as we know. And, of course, there was a lot of things going on through my head. But at some point, I was seeing myself almost dialoguing with God. And you would say, well, what do you mean, God? And I talk in the book about the gods of the wire walker, the gods of the wind, the gods of the balancing pole, as if all those objects or elements were actually alive and made of energy. And to me, they were. It was an escapade of a poetic outlook on a high wire, a theatrical director who chose to perform on a very narrow stage, a quarter of a mile in the sky. I received a phone call on September 11th, and my friends on the other side, and they said, Philippe, your towers are being destroyed. Now, the expression your towers was very common among my friends, and that's the way I referred to the towers. I had put a part of me in it. I had married them. So that day, like millions of people, I stayed glued all morning, all day. And how I felt there is something very hard for me to get into, because there was a very personal appartenance to those buildings. There was almost a kinship, and I felt something alive was being pulled out of me. But how can I even share those thoughts when actually the erasure of those magnificent buildings came with thousands of lives being destroyed? So I have to tint my memory of the enormous human disaster. There had been a lot of talking and planning, and at some point, they stop asking the architects, what do you think? They start asking the people who live in New York, the people who love New York. And at some point, I actually voiced my wish, my concerns, my love for the towers, and I show my drawings. And my idea was to twist the tower along their vertical axis, just like a quarter of a twist, to give them something beautiful and a panache. And I saw a little bit of that in one of the renderings. So nobody knows if those towers will be rebuilt as two towers, but if they are, I certainly hope they will be even more majestic and more magnificent and more daring, and I certainly would offer to walk again.
Philippe Petit is a high wire walker and author of To Reach the Clouds, My High Wire Walk Between the Twin Towers. We spoke to him at his home in Paris. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Alina Mata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, Sky Road, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with technical assistance tonight from John Parati in Boston and Robert Frazier in Washington. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is